Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better and more just world.
Good morning, everybody. It's Alex Lynn-Ferner here, the General Secretary of the Climate Justice Coalition. And today we have an exciting installment of the podcast Just Us and the Climate, and I'll be your host today. And I am joined in studio by Ruth Ntlokotse, who is the president of the South African Federation of Trade Unions, and excitingly is also joining the Climate Justice Coalition as coordinator for the next 9 months, as our other coordinator goes on maternity leave. And we're very excited to have Ruth joining us. And so we wanted to dedicate a special podcast to thinking about building sort of red-green alliances and thinking about how trade unions and climate justice activists can transform the world together. And so, yeah, I think this is going to be a very exciting and important topic. And we really want to think about, you know, the important role that trade unions have to play in the climate justice movement and their conceptions of what it means to deliver on climate justice, on what a just energy transition is. And so I think there are few better people to be speaking to than Ruth Ntlokotse, given her deep background in the trade union movement. And I maybe wanted to start the podcast by speaking a little bit about that with you, Ruth. So welcome and thanks for joining us.
Good morning and thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you, Ruth. So you've been a trade union activist and leader for quite a few years. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that background to start off with. But also maybe what is it that attracts you to the trade union space, makes you want to dedicate your efforts there? What are maybe your favorite elements of, you know, trade union work? And maybe if you feel like it, you can also share what are your most frustrating elements of the work too.
Okay. No, thank you so much. And thanks for inviting me. Let me first start by appreciating the opportunity presented that I am, for me to be part and parcel of the Climate Justice Coalition. I'm very excited about the role. Maybe just to give a bit of a background in relation to where I'm coming from as a trade union leader and activist. I started working for Johnson Smith in 2000, permanent, but I was the, I did my service training there. The company that I was working for, we were manufacturing the catalytic converters. It's a manufacturing company. What made me to join the trade union? It is after the realization that you cannot win if you are raising issues on your own. I mean, coming from the background, I mean, I did my matric during those olden days of apartheid, and I was an activist even at the Technicon. I was the member of SASCO, and I know for sure that raising issues as a collective, that's where issues get heard. So I moved along those lines. And joining the work environment, there are quite a number of issues that I realized that, I mean, fighting for inclusion in the workplace, I mean, there was a lot of transformation that needs to happen. From 1997 up to until 2003, one would get a sense that we were just immediately coming out of the apartheid and we were on the democratic dispensation. And the labor laws and even the policies that were governing the workplace, they were still backward and were fighting for a transformation. And workers, especially black workers, were very much disadvantaged and to such an extent that we're fighting for exclusion. So that's when I realized that I have to be part and parcel of those that are fighting for a transformation in the workplace. I think these are some of the things that led me to join the trade union. There was no empowerment, especially of black workers. We were not regarded with our qualification. Like I said, that I did my service training from 1997, and I only became permanent in the year 2000. That on its own will simply tell you that we had to fight a lot and in a workplace. And, I mean, the policies that were governing the workplace, I mean, they were very backward. There was no inclusion of black workers. I mean, the employment equity We had to fight for the inclusion of black workers. We had to fight for transformation. We had to fight making the point that black workers are also part and parcel of management. So these are some of the things that propelled me, that made me to join the labor movement. And at the time, we were still negotiating at the plant level. I mean, when it comes to the time of a wage increase, it used to be a mammoth task. Mm-hmm. So we realized that we cannot fight when we are divided. And fortunately, I was elected as the shop steward. Ever since, workers had confidence in me, and I had to participate representing workers at the level of the union activities. And ever since from then, I serve in various structures of the organization, because of, you cannot just be a shop steward who is not carrying the mandate of workers and carrying the mandate of the union to the workers. So I was sort of a person who was bringing information from workers, because of at the time, NUMSAID was still the worker control organization. So I would serve as a buffer that will take information from workers to the union, and at the same time bring information of union to the workers. So basically that's who I am. Mm. And then I became the chairperson of Ekurhuleni. Before that, I became the treasurer of Ekurhuleni.
This is in NUMSA, huh?
In NUMSA, yeah. Yes. And 2016, I was elected as the chairperson of the region. You know, in NUMSA, there were no provinces. That we don't have provinces, because of, we don't demarcate municipality. We don't resemble the municipality demarcation. So it's only regions. So I was the chairperson of the region. And then I was also elected as their second deputy president. That was in 2016. Hmm. And I was also the national chairperson of gender. So I serve in various structures. So my list is a bit endless in terms of the roles that I occupied in NUMSA. But coming to the topic that we are dealing with, the one that is related to the climate justice, I was deployed representing the national office bearers to the organizing collective bargaining and campaign unit. So by virtue of me serving in that responsibility, I was representing the union in various platforms, even outside the organization. Mm. So that's where I would interact with climate environmental organization representing the union there. Mm. So that's basically my role in terms of the trade union and how I would interact with the external organizations.
Mm, thanks very much, Ruth. It's good to get that rich history that you have within the trade union space. And I think, you know, both the federation that you're part of, so the South African Federation of Trade Unions, as well as NUMSA itself, are really key trade unions when it comes to questions of, you know, the just transition and climate change. And I think there's two elements, particularly with NUMSA, where they represent both automotive workers and they represent mine workers. And both of those are really vulnerable in the transition to renewable energy. You know, with the automotive sector, we see the transition to electric vehicles putting at risk a lot of the internal combustion engine vehicle supply chain. And with the transition to renewable energy, you know, a lot of coal worker jobs are also at risk if we aren't putting in place a proper just transition. And I think your experience at Johnson Meth, is that the name for the company?
Johnson Methy
speaks to a little bit of the vulnerability of workers as that transition happens. I don't know if you'd be happy to speak about like what happened there in terms of the catalytic converters and the European transition to electric vehicles.
Okay. Thank you so much, and thanks for reminding the pain that we went through as workers in Johnson Methy. Indeed, NUMSA is organizing in the most vulnerable sectors that are affected by the impact of climate change. There's transport. Mm. There's, like you said, the auto, the motor. Mm. We are also in mining, in energy. Mm. So various sectors that are impacted negatively with the climate change. But zooming into the question that you've just asked me in relation to the auto sector, I will just not deal with the value chain. I'll just concentrate on the downward stream of the value chain, which is the automotive components of the auto sector. You know, most of the companies, especially at that level, they are multinational companies. They are coming from Europe, America, and you name them. So the company that I happened to work for that period of almost 26 years, it was coming from Europe. So with this EU policy of decarbonization by 2030, the company had to restructure its operation at the global level. It was existing in 17 countries, and they had to downscale the manufacturing of the catalytic converters by 50%. So meaning that most of the plants that they organized, they had to downscale. So meaning that they are no longer going to manufacture the catalytic converters. So the plant here in South Africa, it was the only plant here in Africa. It was also the victim of that decarbonization policy because of they had to close down the plant. And how that process happened, we feel that workers were left out.
Yeah.
Were left out on the basis that even the notice to close down the company, we were only notified April, the 4th of April, that by end of October, the company is closing down.
Yeah.
Raising all those sorts of things that it's no longer profitable, and they were raising an issue of that decarbonization policy. They will be now concentrating on hydrogen, production of hydrogen energy. But their focus will be more in Europe, just to pilot. So once that project of piloting that the initiative that they were venturing, it's fully fledged, that's when they will consider as to whether can they come back and invest in Africa. So workers were left out. We couldn't, I mean, like I said, that how the notice came about, production was shut down, and then we were called, someone from Europe came and bring that message. So we were not part and parcel of giving alternatives as to how should that just transition happen. The only thing that we concentrated on, it was the packages. What is it that was put on the table? Because it was even said on that particular day that they're going to make sure that we are paid as per the legislations of here in South Africa. But ensuring that workers are not worse off, we were left... we're not taken into confidence. Because of if you can look at what the government of South Africa did, they are now in a process of piloting that hydrogen, manufacturing the hydrogen, green hydrogen. So we were of the view that if most probably we were part and parcel of that just transition, giving some suggestion, we would have proposed that why can't our plant, rather than just shutting it down, why can't it be utilized as one of the plants that will manufacture that green hydrogen? So unfortunately. And I must indicate that we're even disappointed by our union. How our union dealt with our plant, they were not there. To say the least, and thanks to SAFTU, because of SAFTU intervened. And there were quite a number of multifaceted issues that are involved in terms of the closure of the company, the issue of the industrial policy, it was also part and parcel of it. But how SAFTU dealt with that, there was an intervention by seeking an audience with the Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition. And we received an audience. So unfortunately, the manner in which industrial policy was structured, we couldn't be saved as workers. And then we had to approach the IDC with an intention of looking at the repurposing of the plant. So unfortunately, and with the intention of getting the buyer so that the jobs of workers can be saved. And looking at the green hydrogen space, because of we felt that approaching the Department of DTIC, most probably it could be an option that the government might consider to utilize our plant for the manufacturing of that green hydrogen, looking at the technology that is there, whether is it feasible to be utilized and stuff like that. We traveled the chain with SAFTU. Unfortunately, our union, it was not there. I think it could be for political reasons because of the position that I occupied, but workers suffered. You know, if there was a distinction that they would have put aside the political difference that I had with them and concentrate on what was confronting workers at that particular time. Most probably, situation could have been different, but workers were left behind. And when it comes to the issue of empowerment as well, which is one of the pillars of a climate justice, the values of climate justice, we feel that we were a bit disadvantaged. We didn't have an agency of acting autonomously in ensuring that there is retraining, there is recapacity, so that workers, they can be able to be absorbed in another space, especially when it comes to the jobs that might be created through that climate jobs. So we were not given that opportunity. So when we were engaging on the package, our concentration was on more on money without necessarily on looking at the broader picture. So I think that's one of the things that I felt that we were left behind. And then lastly, it is issue of collaboration. We, you know, the climate justice organization or the organization that are advancing for the climate justice, to be honest, they were not there. We were alone. We felt that, you know, continuously we talk about the just transition, ensuring that workers are not left behind, workers are not just destitute. There was no element of collaboration. And that collaboration, even within the trade union space, there was no collaboration amongst ourselves, which is one of the things that we've picked up, that amongst the labor space, it's something that is fading away. So these are some of the experience that workers experience in my plant. And believe you me, it is not only in Johnson Methy. It is the similar situation across the value chain of the automotive sector that workers feel a bit left out, vulnerable, that they were not represented by their own trade union. That was an unfortunate situation. I'm not too sure as to whether can I venture also into another space. You know, I'm currently writing a paper, which is my master's dissertation. I was looking at critiquing the strategy of the union of labor when it comes to the fourth industrial revolution. I feel that there has to be a focus of critiquing the union strategy when it comes to the just transition. I think it's one of the areas that I told myself that once I've submitted, I'm going to write a paper, share some experience, and come up with recommendations, that there has to be an area of critiquing how trade unions are approaching such a consultation process or such initiatives, together with the climate justice activist. There has to be a document, or there has to be a reconsideration, if we are truly committed in ensuring that this issue of climate, of just transition, it is not only left on paper, it is converted into irreality. Because of once we start talking about, I mean, workers in Eskom, in Komati, what actually happened to them is almost similar to what we went through in Johnson Bay. That the union only came and negotiate for their package. And when it comes to their livelihood, I mean, workers lost their livelihood. The community around that area lost their livelihood. I can tell you that even Johnson Methy, because of the community around that area, they would give accommodation to the workers in Johnson Methy. There were people who were selling some stuff, relying on the people, the money that people from Johnson Methy would come in. So meaning that the livelihood, not only of workers in Johnson Methy, even the community around Johnson Methy, they lost because of the closure of that company. So that's why I'm saying that there has to be a reconsideration as to how, I mean, critiquing our strategy as to whether is it something that we really need to do something, you know, do something. And I can tell you that what Johnson Methy did, because of when it comes to supplying the catalytic converters to other suppliers like the VWs and the Ford, we were told that VW told them that we cannot allow, we gave you a 5-year contract, and we cannot allow a situation where, like, you're promising us that you can supply those products outside South Africa. We are going to have a problem when it comes to the localization content. And what the company did, they had to produce between April and October. They had to build stockpile for the period of 5 years. And I can tell you that as we speak, they've got a warehouse in Gqeberha. They are still supplying those companies.
Okay.
But are workers benefiting as a result of that? So it's something that is linked to the industrial policy. That's why I'm saying that the issue of how Johnson Methy dealt with this issue of Section 189, the closure of the company, is a bit multifaceted.
Yeah.
But looking at the justice part of it, I think we need to really critique our strategy.
Mm. Thanks. There's a lot there, and I think that's a reason why I wanted to start with that particular example, because it illustrates so much of what's important about the just transition, but also what's failing in how we mobilize and come together to actually advocate meaningfully for the just transition to happen. And I think a big part of what you're saying is that, you know, workers, they're not opposed to climate action. What they are opposed to is climate action that comes at their sacrifice,
yes,
that leaves them behind.
Yes.
And that the just transition is something that's spoken about by a government, by activists, but their reality that they experience is things close down.
Yes.
They lose their economic opportunities. Communities are left without, you know, things that used to anchor them in terms of their ability to create livelihoods. And so in order to turn the tides on that, we do need to work together. We need to build that solidarity, which has been missing not only across climate justice activists and trade unionists, but also within the trade union movement itself. And so there's a need to rebuild the trade union movement so that it can fight, not necessarily fight against climate action, but fight for the just transition to be real, right? And so I think this brings me to a question of, you know, what role do you see trade unionists, you know, and maybe this speaks a little bit to your master's thesis, being able to play in driving that agenda, and if they can do it well, what would that look like? And maybe within that, you know, could you say a little bit about what SAFTU's stances are on some of these questions? So it's kind of interconnected, because we're seeing now there's a failure to make the just transition real. So how do you think trade unions could come together to make that real, to fight for those victories? And within that, I think because we as a coalition are trying to bring together other forces to stand in solidarity with workers, how would you want to see that develop in time?
Okay. I think that question is very much crucial.
Mm.
You know, we ended up being gatekeepers.
Mm.
You know, as labor, we lack information. We ended up being gatekeepers that once we start talking about climate justice or just transition, we will say that anything cannot come at the detriment of our mm. jobs.
Yeah.
And then we close everything mm. that it's either this or not.
Yeah.
If it's something that will come at the detriment of our jobs, we're not prepared to engage on it.
Mm.
And this is how we normally deal with this issue here, just transition and climate change. I can tell you that 2022, we experienced the impact of climate change mm. that have a negative impact to the jobs of our members. I'm referring to now as SAFTU.
Mm.
One of our affiliates, Nupsu, they are organizing in the Sunparks, you know, the game reserves.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, workers, they had very frustrating stories to tell, that during the drought, how they lost their wages mm. because of that. They were sharing stories about the floods.
Mm.
If there are floods, what normally happens to them? that they will end up going on short time because of they are not supposed to go and work. And these are not only the frustrations in relation to the climate shocks shared by. It's one of our affiliates.
Yeah.
Another affiliate came and shared an experience that during the storm in Durban,
yeah,
these are the ones that are working as paramedics. They were sharing experiences of how emotionally and psychologically that they had to go and save the situation. We know that the disaster management of South Africa is not as sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And as paramedics, I mean, they've taken an oath that the life of the people, it should be the priority, that they had to make it the point that against all odds, they try to save the lives of the people in that geographical location. So they were telling us that it came with the psychological challenges.
Yeah.
And then you go to another affiliate. I'm trying to tell you how the impact of the climate change in relation to the sectors that SAFTU organizes.
Right.
You go to our farm workers,
right,
in the Western Cape, the Day Zero. Workers were telling us that they went for a layoff, and then while they are on layoff, remember that security of tenure, the farms, that if you're not working there, there were others that were even kicked out by the farm owners.
Right.
So that on its own, it tells you that the issue of climate change, it's not something that we need to put it, like approach it in the manner in which we've been approaching it. We need to change the focus. And I can tell you that in 2011, 2012, NUMSA went for an energy conference where they took very progressive resolutions.
Right.
And most resolutions, in actual fact, if you can go to the COSATU, because at that particular time, we're still under COSATU. NUMSA was still under COSATU. We took the resolutions from that energy conference to COSATU. The just transition approach by COSATU, it is coming from that conference.
Right.
And what actually happens after that? I mean, there's absolutely nothing.
Mm.
Some of our progressive resolutions, they're gathering dust
right
there. And believe you me, one of the aspects that I can attest that, you know, worker education,
yeah,
which goes to empowerment,
mm-hmm,
it gives or it allow or it open up a space of workers losing their agency,
right,
autonomy. I mean, if you are empowered, if you are not empowered, you cannot be able to have that agency of acting independent so that you can be able to challenge whatever situation. So these are some of the challenges that the trade unions now lately, we no longer concentrate on worker education. It might be for political reasons, because sometimes leaders, if workers get empowered, workers get capacitated, they might threaten the position or even the position, even the views of the leadership.
Right.
So the more workers are not empowered, the more workers are not capacitated, it is an advantage for them. So coming back to the, what is it that the SAFTU together with the coalition needs to focus on?
Yeah.
I think the most fundamental or the starting point that needs to be looked at is empowerment. It might also be linked to resources that I know SAFTU is a new baby. It was only formed in 2017 and we're still grappling, you know, with some resources. But I can tell you that if there can be some ways that are developed just to put shop stewards together so that we share some experiences.
Right.
I mean, amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
The fortunate part is that we're deployed in those different areas. We're able to share experiences that from affiliate A, these are the things that you experience. And then come up with a way of how workers can be able to be an advocate of climate justice because of the values that the trade union stand for.
Mm.
These are the similar values of what the climate justice seeks to achieve.
Yeah.
The issue of social equity, the issue of fighting for fairness, making sure that those that are vulnerable, they've got, you democratize the process, they've got their own voice in ensuring that what is it that needs to happen. You create that space. Issues of empowerment, build capacity, and issue of solidarity. So that's why I'm saying that this is one thing that we need. It has to be the starting point. And definitely the CJC must be able to give an assistance so that the voice of labor, I mean, before you become a worker, you are a member of your community. So it cannot be that you will turn a blind eye, whereas you have been displaced by the climate shocks. And being displaced of where you reside, being displaced that the work that you used to do because of that area. So workers are suffering. Are suffering being workers, are suffering being members of the community. So that is why the issue of empowerment together with solidarity is very much critical, especially for the CJC.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think if we can really build that empowerment and work together, and, you know, I think breaking down some of the antagonisms that have happened in the past, because I think there's been some misconceptions between, you know, some of the old traditional environmental movements have seen labor as in opposition to climate justice. And that's a false idea, because there is, as you talked about, this NUMSA resolutions from previously, as far back as 2013, 2014, these really progressive resolutions. And I want to focus on one in particular, which is the I think NUMSA was at the forefront of the call for social ownership of renewable energy. And I think there's a bit of blame on environmentalists for falsely painting trade unionists as opposed to climate action. But there is also a little bit of the resolution not coming to life and not being developed and not being pushed as strongly as it should be. But maybe can you speak about, you know, that question of social ownership of renewable energy, why NUMSA put it forward, and also why it's so important?
I think the importance of the of that resolution, it was after we realized, I'm not going to go to the challenges that our utility is confronted with. Like I said, that we, NUMSA is organizing that sector.
In Eskom.
Yes, in Eskom. That, I mean, issues of corporatization, and we realized that slowly our power utility is going to be privatized. And we know the implications of privatization, that the cost of electricity increasing, energy poverty, accountability, that once an entity, I mean, this is the, it's one of the national key point, that if it's not preserved, I mean, there will be some decision taken at the back without the society knowing. So we had to fight for the democratization first of the utility. That the manner in which the utility is structured, there has to be a democratization. There must be, the public must be able to give a direction of how issues of energy should be conducted with an intention of ending in energy poverty. And we know that it's only 85%, although the numbers can be disputed, that are having access to electricity. And I can tell you that with load shedding, with an increased price of electricity, numbers are possibly going down. And then we said that we need a power utility. Although there are debates around that as to the socially owned, what is it that we are referring to? I think I'll come to that part at a later stage. Because of immediately after that resolution, there were some debates as to what is it that NUMSA was actually referring to. But basically what we were advancing for the democratization of the energy generation. So the confusion that I was talking about earlier on, especially when it comes to the socially owned renewable, it is almost, I think it is happening now in VW,
yeah,
in Quebec, where the company decided, I'm not too sure, I think I'm no longer following those processes, okay, that they're going to have their, generate their own electricity. I know that BMW, they've started doing that. It was 30%. Yeah. I don't know how far is that process. That, it's one of the, it can be regarded as one of the socially owned, that you generate your own electricity. Mm. And then others would argue that if that's the case, meaning that municipality in that area might suffer, mm, because of the wood getting money from that company. So if they're no longer getting that, so meaning
so from the sale of electricity, the yes, revenues that they
yes,
get.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, it was regarded as one of the socially owned, that they're owning their own electricity and stuff like that. So that, hence I'm saying that, you know, without implementing the resolution or taking the resolution into practical implementation, there will be some interpretation,
right,
different interpretation about the resolution. So as things stand, even the ranks of workers, there's a bit of a confusion, right, as to what is it that the resolution was actually referring to such an extent that even if someone can come and say, no, this is what it was referring to, and the other one come, workers will simply follow because of they are not empowered.
Okay.
They don't even understand what is it that resolution wanted to achieve at the end of the day. Hence, empowerment of workers is very critical in this aspect.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that, you know, we as the Climate Justice Coalition also trying to build on is, you know, the early NUMSA resolutions and earlier work around the need to push for social ownership of renewable energy. You know, as a coalition, we try to bring that to life through our Green New ESCOM campaign, which is really about ensuring that ESCOM is a driving agent in ensuring social ownership of renewable energy, both through publicly driven renewable energy that ESCOM itself owns and through the democratization of ESCOM, but also through facilitating community ownership of renewables. But I think what we see now under the ANC government is just the widespread liberalization of energy, where it's basically those with the capital and the land that are taking advantage of renewable energy. So you've got big, you know, multinational corporations, the wealthy, the affluent, who can afford to buy renewable energy, that are, you know, running towards it and investing huge amounts, while the vast majority who are stuck reliant on ESCOM, who maybe can't afford the upfront cost of renewables, are being left behind. And so I think you have this like privatized, almost energy apartheid that's developing, where the wealthy and the affluent can do renewables and the rest are being left behind. And so I think this is where the social ownership can be important, not just in empowering trade unions, but about, this is a question about everybody's right to energy access. And if we're not pushing social ownership and we're leaving it up to the private sector, then, you know, those with money, who are very few in South Africa, will be the ones that benefit. And so, yeah, I think this is such a key struggle where we can work together and where we can, you know, forge united fronts, not just between trade unionists and climate justice activists, but everybody who's impacted by energy injustice. And this is a key part of the work that we need to do, which maybe brings me to...
Can I just raise something
Go
in relation to the socially owned renewable?
Yeah.
You know, the experiences, which is another confusion. I think it's very much critical, especially when it comes to this 1 million climate jobs, that in Northern Cape, where we've got most of those solar companies, some of them, I know that NUMSA would organize, others they're not organized.
Yeah.
And among other fears that workers are having was that during the, when they're building the infrastructure, jobs will be there.
Mm.
And as time goes by, once the site is fully fleshed and up and running, it's only few people that will be operating that site. And workers would be saying that once we push for this socially owned, meaning that this 1 million jobs, climate jobs, it's a bit of a fallacy. It's something that is far-fetched. And then secondly, workers were raising the conditions of service that it's operating like almost like a free zone, economic free zone,
right,
where they're not covered by the regulations that are related in this country. And there were some concerns about the violation of labor rights of workers, that workers are not covered by the bargaining councils. So that's why I'm saying that also issue of empowerment, it's very crucial that we need to teach, or, you know, someone was telling me that one of the mistakes that the environmental activists would normally do is to sit, design their own agenda, and take the agenda, almost what we're discussing up there, and want to impose it to workers. That hence, there must be a bit of a different approach in dealing with that aspect of the socially owned renewables. I felt that that impact, it's very important.
It actually reminds me, I did my graduate studies in Seattle and Washington, and I was part of a state-led coalition there where labor was a leader. It's called the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy, and it was environmentalists and trade unions working together. And one of the key elements of the policy that they put forward is that state investment in renewable energy must come with strong labor protections, with good unionized jobs, and so that this can be at the core of a climate justice agenda if, you know, the trade unionists are there at the table making policy together rather than being brought in afterwards. And so I think you find when we sit at the table together and develop policy that we can do good things. And I know in New York State, for example, they also just passed a Build Public Renewables Act, which is about the, you know, the state stepping in and investing in renewables, and that good labor standards and practices must be at the core of that. But another part of what you raised there is that, you know, in the manufacture of renewables, there's some jobs, but, you know, it's not that many. And that actually where you want the jobs is a lot of the upstream, the production of the renewables. So the installment is just a small part of the actual job creation. And as you say, once the installation is done, there's not that many there. So this is where the green industrialization push is also important. And you talked about industrial policy, because most of the jobs in the renewables are upstream. They are in the manufacture. They may be even in the critical minerals that are mined to develop it. And so as I think working together as trade unionists and environmental activists, that's an area where we can fight to make the 1 million climate jobs real, is through green industrialization policies that have strong worker benefits. And so that'll be an important element of working together. And maybe this brings me to sort of a question about thinking about the vision that unites us, right? Because you spoke a bit about like the fact that we are grounded in similar values, the trade union movement and the climate justice movement. And I thought I'd bring a quote here from the General Secretary of SAFTU, Zweli Mzimavavi. And he says that acting on climate change and a just transition should be the basis of a profound socioeconomic transformation. That is only the only way to achieve a zero carbon world. And so maybe, because what we need is movements as well as big visions of like what that transformation looks like that can inspire us. So I don't know if you can say more about what you think that profound transformation could and should look like. If we're thinking about like what is the vision that unites climate justice activists and trade unionists? And sorry, that's a very big question to throw you away. But I think this is part of our role, is to maybe be a bit more utopian in our thinking and to think about like, if we are going to fight together, we must have a vision that inspires us. And, you know, I can hesitate some answers towards that, but I want to put it in your court first before,
I think what should unite us as labor and the climate activist is the fact of acknowledging that the jobs of workers are crucial. The livelihood, it's very important. And more importantly is that climate change is real. I think it has to be the starting point that there has to be an acceptance that climate change is real. We are seeing the impact. You know, I was talking to my son yesterday that I normally go out for a jog in the morning. Mm. That if you can look at 5:30, it's now dark. Mm. And we don't even know where we are. We have three seasons in one day. In the morning, it's hot, it's cold. During the day, it's extremely hot. Mm. In the evening, it rains. And with I mean, we saw yesterday what happened even then, Brakpan, that there was snow all of a sudden.
The hail that came.
The hail and stuff like that. Mm. So we must accept that climate change is real, the livelihoods of people, and at the same time, when we transition, it has to be the transition that takes into consideration that we cannot go to the economy that will continuously harm the environment.
Yeah.
So the policies that needs to be adopted.
Yeah.
It has to be the policies that are not harming the environment. I think it has to be one of the issues that also unite us.
And I think this brings me to a quote from, you know, one of the steering committee members of the coalition. It's Mametlwe Sebei, the president of General Industries Workers Union of South Africa. And he says that, you know, the same economic system that exploits workers is the one that's exploiting the environment, right? And so if we connect that, it's the same rapacious sort of extractive capitalist logic that's harming both, right? This is an opportunity for us to unite together to tackle that on and to try build an economic system that puts at its core the well-being of workers, the well-being of communities, and well-being of the environment. And I think that's particularly important in the South African context because, you know, we have one of the most extractive economies in the world. It's made us the most unequal economy on some measures. It's also made us one of the most polluting economies on other measures. And those things are combined. It's because it's that same extractive logic that drives us. And so if we can forge those united fights together, this might be the opportunity that we can to overthrow the sort of economic structures that still linger from apartheid, that drive both the climate crisis, the ecological crises that we face locally, as well as the economic and inequality crisis and the worker crisis that we face, right? And so I think we see South Africa as not a tenable society and that we need deep transformation. So this is our opportunity to fight for it together.
I think the moment is now.
Yeah.
We cannot allow an opportunity of procrastinating, looking at the crisis that we are existing almost in a polycrisis. I mean, crisis are existing almost at the same time.
Yeah.
So the moment is now for us to unite. And that unity, of course, we need not to gatekeep. We need not to be positional. We need to understand what is it that we are confronted with. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, looking at the root cause, like you're saying, that the economic system is the root cause of what confront us. Mm-hmm. So what is important is how do we unite, I mean, at the global level. Mm-hmm. And unity should start where we are. Mm-hmm. And then how do we make sure that the vulnerable, those that are marginalized, are afforded an opportunity to be part of the processes without necessarily looking at them down, making sure that they come up with alternatives, the alternatives that will salvage their situation. I think it is also another crucial element that the CJC must look at it. I think gradually we take everyone on board, we will be able to overcome and challenge the system that you are confronted with. But what is central, the climate change is real. We cannot run away from it.
It's real.
I'm a worker. I used to be a worker. I am a victim of climate change. The policies that we didn't engage, the policies that as labor we don't find them suitable, or we don't go and lobby that whatever policies that are adopted, they shouldn't be detrimental when they're implemented to workers. So I think these are some of the things that needs to be considered. So it cannot be that as workers we are immune, we cannot be affected by the climate shocks. No.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's it. It's recognizing there's the victims of climate change, the physical impacts of climate change, and the victims of the climate policy. And that, you know, we must fight to ensure that both victims, that they aren't victims of climate policy, that the just transition measures protect people, but that also that we're transforming economies to protect people from other climate shocks. And these are dual challenges, and it takes us working together to make that happen. Which I think is sort of starting to bring us towards the tail end of this conversation. And I did want to, I mean, I think this call to unite and work together, and that, you know, there's an urgency to this moment that we can't ignore. So maybe to sort of round it off, I wanted to give you an opportunity, if there's anything you'd like to share in terms of encouraging people to get involved, different ideas you might have for people working on the interface of labor, politics and climate justice. I think we've touched on it already quite a lot within this discussion, but just to give you a sort of an opportunity as we close up, if there's any other ideas or calls to action that you want to share.
Okay. I think to labor, the values that the trade unions advocate for, which is the social equity, which is about fairness, inclusion, reduction of disparities, equitable policies and practice. Secondly, worker empowerment, which gives agency, autonomy, and be able to engage independently. And then lastly, on the values, which is solidarity, because the climate change, the impact of climate change, it's a global phenomenon. We cannot win in challenging climate change if we don't collaborate. Trade unions, we've got a history of, I mean, some of us, we subscribe to Marx, and we know that normally we tell people that we've got international, we are international in character, we are for solidarity, and to an extent that we know that Marx would normally would say that workers was advocating for unity of workers across the globe, that you've got nothing to lose but your chains, meaning that the trade union, we can unite across sectors, we can organize, we can unite irrespective of our geographical location. These are all the values that the climate justice seeks to achieve. So meaning that once, as a trade unionist, you fight for that values, you must know that you are fighting for the values of climate justice. So there's no gray area. If you are a trade union activist, you must know that the values that you're advocating for, these are the very same values for climate justice. So the message that I would like to bring to, especially to labor, is that let's not stand outside of this process. We are impacted directly by the climate change. I mean, we are seeing the shocks. We are displaced where we reside. We are displaced where we work. We are on layoff. Some of us, we are retrenched. And then others, I know that there's a company in a Western Cape where we were told that they will be shutting down. It's still across the value chain of auto sector that they will be shutting down now in March. More than 1,000 workers will be affected because of this decarbonization policy. So we are saying that we cannot just be folding our hands and be bystanders and without necessarily joining hands, coming in solidarity with other activists that are fighting this climate change. We are saying that those that are perpetrators, those who are polluting the environment, we must make it a point that they're held liable. It cannot be correct that the marginalized, the vulnerable, are the ones that must pay the price of the climate change. So we must make it a point that we unite, we join hands, we become in solidarity, we understand. I mean, the slogan of an injury to one is an injury to all.
Yeah.
Those that are impacted by climate change, shocks, the polycrisis of climate change, we are with them.
Mm.
So I think these are the words that I would like to say to the trade unionist. And you, being a trade unionist, you must know that you're the member of the community.
Yeah.
Before you go to work, you reside in a particular in a certain community. So it cannot be that you'll divorce yourself from issues that are affecting your community.
Yeah.
So let's stand up. Let's make it the point that we revive, we resuscitate our activism.
Mm.
So that's what I wanted to say, especially to the trade unionist.
Thank you so much, Ruth. And maybe if I can mirror your call to action, because you have said that, you know, the values that trade union movements stand up for are parallel to the values of the climate justice movement. And so trade unionists should stand up for climate justice. And I think the call should also go the other way around, is that climate justice activists must stand up with the trade union movement because the values are the same and the world we're trying to build is, you know, one grounded in justice. And so this is my echoing of your call, saying that, you know,
indeed,
it's time for the climate justice movement to stand up and to fight with trade unions and to ensure that they are, that the story of your factory is not the story of the transition, is an anomaly, not the key narrative, right? And that's vitally important. So thank you so much, Ruth, for joining us. I think this has been such a really rich conversation. You know, this is a call to all of our coalition members and all listeners to be actively involved and to think about how we can forge solidarity across movements. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be the family member of the CJC. Thank you so much. We're looking forward to
working
together.
Welcome to the family.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production of the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the coalition and our work to advance climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and share it widely. The more people it reaches, the more we can help grow the movement for climate justice. This podcast is made possible thanks to the financial support of the Open Society Foundation.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.